And now, it's the Florida Spectacular Podcast, hosted by Kathy Celestri. Find Kathy on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Celestri, CathySalustri, on Facebook at Celestri Kathy, and visit her website, GreatFloridaRoadTrip.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Welcome back to the Florida Spectacular. I'm your host, Kathy Celestri, and today joining us, we have Florida author Rick Kilby. Rick Kilby is the very recent author of a great book called Florida's Healing Waters, Gilded Age Mineral Springs, Seaside Resorts, and Health Spas. Rick, thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. I've been a big fan of your work for quite a long time, since you had your first book came out. And I remember you spoke at the History Center at our Tacky Tourist event here in Orlando. If you don't remember, it was right when there was a big deluge.
I remember I had a car accident on the way there. Rick is talking about the Orange County Regional History Center, which is Orlando. And if you are in Orlando and all you think is Disney, that's a huge mistake, because they have a beautiful, I'm so jealous. I'm president of the Gulfport Historical Society, and we're fortunate enough to have a city building. We use an old church, but the Regional History Center is just incredible. And they have a wonderful Tupperware exhibit, because Tupperware is a Florida creation. People don't realize that. But yes, I remember it very well, Rick. And I'm anxious to come back and do something very soon. I imagine y'all will be reopening soon.
Yeah, they actually reopened early in the summer with, you know, social distancing and mask requirements and all that kind of stuff. And just in time, because they had this incredible exhibit on the Ocoee Massacre that started in the fall and went through the spring. And they were very fortunate that they had pretty decent attendance despite the pandemic. And it's, you know, it was a very, very important exhibit, and it was the 100th anniversary of that event. So I'm pleased that they were able to open for it. But who knows what's happening now? The governor reopened the state basically for everything.
I'm vaccinated, so I guess I'm okay with it. But the Ocoee Massacre, I'm going to assume that the Indians were triumphant in that.
No, the Indians were not part of that. Are you familiar with the Ocoee Massacre?
I think I am confusing Ocoee is along State Road 50, and I think I'm confusing it with somewhere else. I was mostly keying off the saying that when the Indians are triumphant, it is called a massacre, and when the Europeans are triumphant, we call it a victory. clearly, I'm wrong. Tell us a little bit about the Ocoee Massacre.
Well, it is the biggest recorded incident of voting day violence in American history. It started when an African-American man decided to vote. He was encouraged by a judge here in Orlando named Donald Cheney. I think it was Donald Cheney. There were two judges. John Cheney was one and Donald Cheney was one. So I might get them mixed up. And he tried to vote. They turned him away. He came back to the judge. The judge tried to encourage him. But ultimately, it ended up with a man named July Perry being lynched very close to the judge's house. And the large community of Ocoee, which were a lot of citrus workers, the huge African-American community, was actually run out of town. A number of people died. There is controversy about how many people died. They could confirm only, you know, like a half dozen deaths or maybe less, but a lot of people say it was much, much larger. But what ultimately happened is they burned down all the property owned by African-Americans, ran them out of town. And up until the 1970s, it was known as one of those sundown towns where African-Americans didn't go. And it was very kind of comparable to Rosewood, maybe, which is a more, you know,
more well-known,
know that better.
Perhaps.
Yeah. And they got, you know, the timing was very good because it came out before the election, and it, you know, it covered the gamut, you know, from the introduction of slaves by the Spanish all the way through modern day voter suppression, which is so interesting because, you know, when they created the exhibit last summer, voter suppression looked very different than it does now, because so much of it has occurred since the election.
Well, it's unfortunate, something that's still happening. And wow. No, I feel incredibly ignorant, but that's one of the beautiful things about this podcast, is that I'm constantly learning new things about my state. I wouldn't wouldn't say that that's one of the more spectacular things, although I guess we could say the fact that we're attempting to educate people and learn from the hatred of the past may show us a more peaceful pathway forward in the future. So
The timing was incredibly important, and they actually passed a law in the prior legislative session where it has to be taught about in Florida schools. So
good.
Students will learn about the Ocoee Massacre. So it's a very positive thing. And they got a lot of great publicity, you know, because of the timing, the Washington Post, it was on the Smithsonian website, the New York Times, everybody wrote about it. So it was a good thing ultimately based on that tragedy.
Well, anytime we can learn from our past, there's a chance we won't repeat it.
Yeah.
Not always a good chance, but a chance. So
yeah.
What a year it's been. You talk about voter suppression and some protesting, but also COVID. I mean, I think health is something we've thought about in new and different ways over the past year. Definitely. And what an interesting time for you to be publishing a book about health. You know, it's, I want to say everything about the way we used to look at our health spas and our spa retreats. I see in your background there, you have, what is that? High Springs? Is that a picture of High Springs behind
you? It's White Springs.
White Springs up in the north end of the state. Yeah. Anytime I do any thinking about how we used to regard health and wellness in Florida, I can't help but thinking of these springs. And then I can't help thinking of a fairly, I guess it's old now, as am I, movie called Road to Wellville. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, very much so. I'm glad you brought that up. And I can't find it anywhere. It's like, I swear to God, the Seventh-day Adventist Church or somebody made it go away. Because I want to find it, you know, on Turner Network or you know, a DVD. And I cannot find it because it's so campy. And that's based on John Harvey Kellogg.
Kellogg.
Who was such a bizarre character. And he actually created a spa in Miami Springs.
So it looks like you can watch it on YouTube or Amazon Prime and Peacock. They say it's free on Peacock. I just did a quick search.
On Amazon Prime. Okay.
That's what it says. I'm going to click, but I hope I don't super. Yeah. Road to Wellville. It is free with Prime.
Oh, I'm totally, you know, I've seen lots of clips on YouTube because, you know, there are certain clips with Bridget Fonda that get a lot of play again and again and again. And it captured the essence of just how zany that was.
No, well, we didn't know. I mean, we didn't know. Just like I'm sure if you ever, I don't know if you watch Star Trek, was it Bones? Whenever they would see a remnant of 20th century medicine, he would just kind of go barbaric. we used to stick forks in people to let the bad spirits out. And Road to Wellville, I loved that movie before I realized it was set in Florida. And of course, I love it even harder now. But let's talk about.
It was really set in Michigan. So the main Battle Creek Sanitarium was in Michigan. But he did a branch in Miami Springs.
Miami.
Which was, who's the big aviator? Glenn Curtis built this hotel in the 1920s with his partner. And it opened up just in time for the Great Depression. So he wanted to unload it. So the story is he sold it to John Harvey Kellogg for $1. John Harvey Kellogg says it was actually $10. But regardless, it is still an old folks home today. And the building is still there.
Does it have a fountain of youth?
I don't think so.
Because you know you can't swing a dead cat in Florida without finding the alleged fountain of youth. That's I live in Gulfport, which is near St. Petersburg, and we have a fountain of youth. St. Augustine, of course, has a fountain of youth. Warm Mineral Springs in Venice is the fountain of youth. And all I can tell people about that is I did drink out of the fountain out of the spring in St. Augustine, and I haven't died yet. So I can't disprove it. Let's talk a little bit about the Fountain of Youth and the idea of it and how it plays into some things in Florida's history, because I love the story, but I don't want to step on any cherished idols for you. So I'll let you talk about the Fountain of Youth.
Well, I have this little graph in my first book, Finding the Fountain of Youth, that shows kind of all the ways the Fountain of Youth existed before Ponce de Leon. You know, there was the sacred waters like the Ganges and the River Jordan, where there's this idea of water being sacred and spiritual and holy. And then there's the literary tradition where supposedly Alexander the Great had a Fountain of Youth. And then there was a king named Prester John who had a Fountain of Youth. And then there are all those places where people made pilgrimages. And then there's places like Lourdes, and I don't know if I pronounce that, in France, where people went for healing. So there's all these traditions, and it's not just the European tradition. It's also an Eastern tradition of sacred waters and healing waters. And so this whole notion of water granting you eternal life existed long before Juan Ponce de Leon ever stepped foot in Florida. And it got attached to him by political rivals who wanted to make him look bad because they were associated with Diego Columbus, who wanted to retain power in Puerto Rico. And so they attached it to him long after Ponce de Leon had departed and left this earth, the planet. Oh, sorry, my phone is ringing.
That's okay.
And that's how we got it. And, you know, Gary Marmino says it's our foundation myth here in Florida.
It is a foundation myth. And I always tell people that when, before it became a myth, it was satire. I said, you know, it was the 16th century equivalent of The Onion or Andy Borowitz. And everybody knew it was satire. But I think if the past 4 or 5 years have taught us anything, it's that if you repeat something loud enough and long enough, people will think it's true. And to be fair, Rick, to be fair, if you've never seen a Florida spring and you stumble upon one, it's not that hard to believe that Ponce de Leon would have seen, for example, Manatee Springs or Peacock Springs or any of them and thought, oh my God, this is the Fountain of Youth. They're absolutely enchanted places. I mean, I think in my first book, I write about taking my husband to, when I was working on the first book, we stopped and we spent the night at Wakaiva Springs State Park. And there was an afternoon thunderstorm rolling in, and he wanted to see the spring and I wanted to see the spring, because if you've been to Wakaiva Springs, you know, the springhead itself is a fairly large springhead compared to others. And I wanted him to see it. I wanted to see it before we broke camp for the night, because we were in a little camper. And I remember we walked down to the springhead and he just looked at me and he said, I'll remember this till the day I die. He just looked at me with wonder in his eyes. And he said, I had no idea. And that's always stuck with me, because the springs are usually in the middle of, I don't know, jungle or whatever we want to call it in Florida, cypress swamp. And then you just stumble upon this hole in the earth and it's teal and it's aquamarine and it looks like you're in a big aquarium, and it just looks like the earth could swallow you right up and you'd be okay with it because it's just so special. So I get it. I get where we could have believed that.
You feel young because the water is so cold. You feel like a little kid, you know, and it's a chill that stays with you. You know, you feel different once you touch the water. There's no doubt about that. I remember I stayed at, there's a little bed and breakfast at Green Cove Springs, and their spring is the municipal pool, and it's only open in warm months. But I remember after I got out of being in the spring about a half hour, sitting on the porch, not wanting to go in because I was still cold. You know, and it was like a half hour after I was out of the water and the chill was still with me, and it kind of resonates in your bones.
it stays with you long after you're out of the water, because some of those springs, if you go up to the, well, you know this, maybe our listeners don't, this, so I'll say it. We tell people, oh, well, the springs are 72 degrees in Florida. Well, that's kind of a range. And I think the coldest spring in Florida is actually about 68 degrees.
Yeah.
And that's not warm. 72 is not warm. Look, I grew up in Florida. I don't go in the water until it's pretty close to 90. So it's a different thing, but it does make you feel different. And as you're basically, your whole book attests. People were willing to believe it made you different. So I can't go through the whole book, but I want you to tell me, of all the historic health spaces in Florida's past, what's the most memorable? What's the one you want everybody in the world to know about?
I would. How about the one near you, Warm Mineral Springs? And I, you know, I squeezed that into the book because, you know, in 1870, Green Cove Springs had all these beautiful wooden hotels and steamboats were stopping there. And it was well known. It was called the Saratoga of the South. Warm Mineral Springs at the same time was probably known about only by cattle ranchers. And they went there, you know, to water their cows. And at some point they built a little primitive spring house. But it really, to put it in the Gilded Age, there wasn't a whole lot more there in the Gilded Age. But to me, the ritual that people still undergo there, where they take the waters in a very traditional way, is the closest thing we have in Florida today to what people have been doing. It's, you know, spring-based spas across the world for hundreds of years. You know, it's the same thing. People come here from a long distance away to have all the minerals and all the things in that water help them feel better. In Warm Mineral Springs, the best example of that.
Well, it's also an outlier in Florida. It is. It's our only warm spring. And yeah. I realize if you're in Minnesota right now listening to this, you're probably thinking 68 is pretty warm, but trust me, it's not. Do you know what makes the mineral springs warm in Venice?
It has to do with the depth of the where the water is coming from. You know,
where's it coming from?
There's several different vents, and I think so generally, like when we talk about a normal spring, if one is 68 degrees and one is 72 degrees, it's because the water at the cooler springs is deeper, you know, so that it's chillier. But I think one of the vents, now this is what I remember, and I could be faulty. My memory is like that sometimes. One of the vents is deep enough that it's close enough to, you know, the earth's inside the earth, there's all sorts of volcanic stuff and it makes it warm. So there's multiple vents and they kind of mixes. And so there's cool vents and warm vents and they mix together. And I think it's like 87 degrees by the time it comes out. There was also a place that they were drilling close to the Everglades down by Naples and they hit another one of those pockets of warm water. And for a brief time, they tried to use it again as amenity to sell houses, like ultimately happens to a lot of the springs. And they called it the Fountain of Youth. And it was like a big fountain where people kind of sat into it. But they, ultimately, they capped that. It didn't exist. But it shows that if you go deep enough, you know, there are little pockets of water that are hot. The other thing I wanted to mention is during the Victorian age, these were all visitors coming down in winter. So, you know, if you're in Jacksonville and it's February, in the 1800s, the temperatures are very cool. So 72 degrees is hot in comparison to the air temperature. So they called them hot springs.
Well, and also, again, when you're for me, I've lived in Florida since I was 7. And I'm serious. I won't go in the water unless it's close to 90. It's just wrong. But I do accept that we get a lot of people from points north where 70 feels just damp fine.
Yeah.
So Warm Mineral Springs, you wanted it included. We talked about the source. That's why I find it so exceptional, just that it's the only one of these in Florida that that would be considered a warm springs. Or I mean, when I think of hot springs, I definitely don't think of even the one in Venice, the Warm Mineral Springs. But why do you think, so you said it would be the one you wanted the world to know about. Why?
What I love about it is, you know, that continuity of tradition, but a lot of the people who come to visit are Eastern European and Russian, and they believe wholeheartedly in the power of these waters. You know, they have, you know, for most Americans, we stop believing in the power of the healing powers of water. In Europe and you know, in Japan, for instance, you know, they still have that hot spring bathing tradition in a lot of parts of Europe too. And the people who come here believe that these waters have healing powers, and the, you know, the amount of minerals there, they say, is unrivaled anywhere on the planet. So you have Eastern Europeans and Russians who move to Northport, Florida in order to bathe on a daily basis. So you can go there and you hear people speaking in Russian. The last time I stayed there, the other thing I love there is the incredible architecture. You know, it was built by the people of the Sarasota School of Architecture. I think Jack West designed the spa buildings there. And then Victor Lundy designed the motel that's there on 41. And I stayed in that little motel and I went and I took the waters and walked around and heard people speaking Russian. And then
I went to a Russian bakery for breakfast because there's, you know, it is the largest Ukrainian population in Florida, is in Northport, Florida, because of the spring. So there's a lot going on. I love the architecture, and they made efforts to preserve the architecture there. Oh, one more thing. There's a cyclorama. I forgot. There's a cyclorama, and there's only about 30 cycloramas left in the entire world. And it's the life of Ponce de Leon. It's this round building, not open to the public anymore, but a lot of the figures still exist. And there's these murals that depict his life. And there was a guy named Lowell Thomas, who was a famous radio host. And he would narrate this. And this was all about the early 60s. They were part of the state's quadricentennial celebration. And they developed all these resources for the quadricentennial. And they expected they were going to have millions and millions of people come. But unfortunately, the Tamiami Trail was under construction, and it really reduced attendance at this place. But it's still there. All that, those wonderful architectural relics are still there.
I will have to. So you can't get in to see that, though.
You'd probably have to make some phone calls. I think you could do it. I think you could do it with your if you called the right people, you could probably make it happen.
I'll tell them that Rick sent me. So I don't want to focus solely on the springs, though, because your book is not just about the springs. It's about seaside resorts. And I love what you write. And people may not realize this. The first thing you say when we talk about Florida beaches, the first thing I remember you writing was that people have not always written positively about Florida beaches and the sea. And you talk a little bit about Jonathan Dickinson, who wrote, what was it, God's Protecting Providence, about being shipwrecked and not dying. And clearly a shipwreck survivor isn't going to have a lot of positivity. But what was so negative about our beaches, and what turned the tide, if you'll pardon the very unintentional but well-timed pun?
So we're so, in this country, Anglo-centric. And so a lot of these traditions are English. And there's a great book called The Beach. And the authors of that book write about how in Northern Europe, in Western Europe, in the English tradition, they feared the sea. You know, there was this kind of mythology about, you know, Kraken and all these creatures of the sea. You know, in the Mediterranean cultures, they bathed in the sea all the time, no big deal. But in the northern part where the water wasn't so warm, they were afraid of it. So they had to really get over that fear of that. And it goes to the whole idea of balneotherapy, which is bathing in the springs. There was a town called Scarborough that had a mineral spring. And some guy wrote a book and thought, you know, well, bathing in the ocean could be good for you, too. And drinking salt water can be good for you, too.
Oh, no. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. Supposedly, they mixed it with milk to make it a little more palatable, which sounds really gross to me. But he wrote a book called Scarborough Spa, and there were all these books that came out. And, you know, this is the time where they're starting to really believe in science, you know, and there's minerals in the water and there's salt, and salt is good for you. And so this whole sea bathing tradition started. And so these seaside resorts in England started popping up at places like Brighton. And you had Queen Elizabeth and Prince Albert, you know, going to Osborne House because they believed in the efficacy of sea bathing. And it started to become kind of a fad. And they had these incredible bathing machines. Because it was the Victorian era, the men could bathe nude, but the women had to have modesty. So they had these big wagons they would roll out into the sea. The women would pop in. There would be attendants who would hold them in the water because they couldn't swim yet. And then right when they were about to drown, pull them out, take them back to the wagon, and then roll it up on shore. Eventually, that tradition came to the United States. So places like Newport, Rhode Island, Bar Harbor, Maine, and Atlantic City, New Jersey started to become popular, and eventually it came to the United States. And I really give Henry Flagler, because he promoted sea bathing at all his resorts that were on the sea. And I think the heyday for sea bathing in Florida was Palm Beach. And you see these wonderful pictures of all these people in their Victorian costumes. I call them costumes, but the Victorian attire, with these big ropes going across the beach because they don't know how to swim yet. And they have to hold on to these lifelines to go into the surf. And it's because they believed it was good for them, and they don't know how to swim. Eventually, though, that died out to the, you know, whole habit of swimming in the surf for recreational purposes. And, you know, it just became swimming as opposed to sea bathing.
If I were going to learn to swim, it would not be in an Atlantic beach. I I live on the Gulf Coast and we have such a gentle beach here, and the Atlantic just chews you up and spits you out. But okay, well, the beach is better now. So, wow, that's the more you know. Okay.
Well, eventually he started having, Flagler started having bathing casinos, which were swimming pools, you know, saltwater swimming pools at his resort hotels. And you can see the kind of shift because they start having swim instructors. And so you, some of the later postcards, people are obviously horsing around and playing in the swimming
pools. How not to die in the water.
Yeah, exactly.
Handy, so, handy stuff.
By the time you get to Miami Beach and Fisher is developing Miami Beach, they have these wonderful bathing casinos, but it's about recreation. It's not about health at that point. So.
And then the only thing that we haven't talked about are the health spas, although we started with that. I mean, not the only thing. There's a lot in your book we're not covering, but I like, you know, I think you're the only book I've ever read that has a chapter that's called, or a section titled, The Birth of Irregular Medicine. And it's really, let's say interesting, although I think I'm underselling it with that. What drew you? I guess let's talk about irregular medicine and some of the things that we did at these health resorts that are just, okay, they go from walking barefoot in wet grass, which, all right, my mother would tell you you'd get a cold from that, but they go a little bit more unusual. So why don't we talk about some of the little bit more unusual?
So if you go back far enough, there is the belief in the four humors, you know, which was bodily fluids, and you had to keep those in balance. So, you know, one of the things they would do was they would bleed you, you know, or put a leech on you and all that kind of stuff, or give you purgatives that would make you expel bodily fluids, you know, and they always had to keep those four bodily fluids in balance. You know, George Washington, great example. They basically bled him to death. Because they bled him so much. So that you're talking about the late 1700s. So you go into the 1800s, a lot of those beliefs persist. And that's heroic medicine. You know, it's the age of patent medicine, you know, where a lot of that stuff had mercury and heroin and opium and all that kind of fun stuff. But irregular medicine are people who look for more natural cures. That, you know, that kind of medicine where you do bleeding and purging and leeches and all that stuff's heroic medicine, where the doctor does heroic measures to try and keep you alive. Irregular medicine is kind of a more, it's like naturopathy and hydropathy, natural processes that kind of arrive from there. So people start thinking, well, why don't we do something like with our diet? Instead of eating meat and potatoes, why don't we incorporate vegetables and whole wheat into our diet? And so people start doing that. And they think, well, maybe exercise is good for you. Maybe water is good for you. You know,
crazy, crazy ideas you've got there.
No. And in some ways, you know, we talked about John Harvey Kellogg. He was way ahead of his time because he promoted vegetarianism, you know, and eating a proper diet and getting exercise, which was, you know, a whole new notion to a lot of those Victorians, you know, to actually move around. But he also was really in love with enemas. And, you know, he believed in enemas after every meal. And when he came down to Florida, he was really into eugenics. And he was, you know, that was really, he had some really creepy things. He had 40 children, but never consummated his marriage. So they were all adopted. And he was just like so far advanced in some ways and so wacky in other ways.
I would almost go with mentally ill for some of this. But
well, supposedly, you know, he started with hydrotherapy and he went to what was called a water cure, where you learn all these hydrotherapeutic practices, but he wanted to know more. So he went to the University of Michigan and learned to be a traditional surgeon. And supposedly he was one of the best surgeons in the country at the time. So he was a genius in some ways, but he was way out in left field than the others. That's why I love Anthony Hopkins' portrayal of him, because you see that little crazy streak in it.
Little? No, I mean, it's, you know, it's, he was an interesting man. I was glad that you didn't just stick to the, well, you know, he ate vegetables and whole grains, because I knew there was more coming with him.
Yeah.
How much did these get taken to heart? These somewhat more adventurous ideas about health. How much were they taken to heart at Florida's spas. And we talked about White Springs, High Spring, you know, a lot of these places where people came to them almost as a sanatorium or something. How much did they take some of the more extreme ideas to heart?
I think there is a cultural component, you know, that's what you did. So if you were in Europe, you know, you went to places like Spa Belgium or Evian, you know, these places we think of just as Perrier as mineral water. Now they had big spas there. And that's what you did when you were in the upper class of society in Europe. And that's what you did. You went to watering places. So, you know, that was the age of consumption. And it was believed that going to, you know, being outdoors was one way to avoid tuberculosis. So if you had, you know, the economic means to do so, you went up to the mountains, you went to the springs where there were spas. So, you know, places like Saratoga Springs were very popular. And there was a bunch of springs in what's now West Virginia and Virginia. You know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson took the waters at Warm Springs. It was kind of a popular thing for the upper class to do. So even if you weren't an invalid, you went to these spas, you know, and you stayed at these hotels, and you probably did the whole regimen of drinking the water and bathing because it's what you did. There were some serious invalids, and I found a great example of this guy named Kyer, who owned a brewery up in Western Pennsylvania, who came here because he was ill. And they kind of go all around the state trying to find some place that will bring them some relief. So you had that, but you also had people who were just members of society. And, you know, the other thing you did when you went to these spas is you promenaded. So, you know, you went up and down these walks in your finest clothes to be seen by others. So you can see there's definitely, you know, there was horse racing at some places, there was golf at some places, and tennis and croquet. So it's not all about taking the waters as a social aspect as well. But a lot of people, even if they weren't ill, did it just because that's what you did.
Well, I know that you mentioned Flagler. I know that he and Plant had a little bit of a, I call it a frenemieship. And you can see in the history of their resorts that they built how one would build a 50-foot swimming pool and the next one would build a 70-foot swimming pool. How these resorts could very much play into this societal health type of, I don't want to call it a fad, but a trend, let's say a trend. You mentioned Flagler. I know that he, I believe both Flagler and Plant, one of the reasons they were in Florida, maybe Flagler more so, my own memory isn't that great, had to do with consumption and their wives. I know the first Mrs. Flagler was very ill. And I joke that the only way doctors thought to treat consumption in the late 19th century was tell people to go to Florida because, well, the warm air will be good for you. But I'm sure.
That's exactly what happened. The doctor's orders. And, you know, I keep thinking I need to keep a list of all these people who became seminal figures in Florida history who were told to come here for their health. You know, great example. There was a writer who came. His name is, escaping me, who came and promoted Orange County, Will Wallace Harney. And he came here because his wife was ill and ultimately she died, but he stayed here and wrote all these wonderful glowing articles about Orange County that went to newspapers up north. And so the same thing happened with Flagler. His wife, his doctor said, your wife is not doing well up here. Take her south during the winter. And they went to St. Augustine and he was not impressed at all, but he came back. And I think he came back with the Rockefellers, and in the time that had elapsed since his first business, there was this beautiful new hotel in St. Augustine called the Magnolia Hotel. And he thought, this reminds me of the places I've seen at the great watering places of Europe. This could be a thing. If I built incredible, you know, opulent hotels here, I could attract the same crowd who, you know, normally would go to Europe to holiday. I could attract them to Florida. And voila. St. Augustine really exploded after that.
Yeah, the man didn't get to be ridiculously wealthy by ignoring opportunity.
No.
He was definitely probably one of the shrewdest Floridians financially. And there's a whole bunch of strange stories about Flagler. I think the strangest one is the bastard married three times. I mean, that's just crazy. but he was definitely a visionary, and yeah, he was unimpressed with St. Augustine because what was it I read? And this was on, I think, the Flagler Museum website. There was a lack of transportation options. So
it was hard to get there because you'd be on a steamboat And then you'd have to get on some kind of carriage or, you know, eventually there was a really rickety railroad that everybody complained about. But, it, you know, it's about right now to drive from St. Augustine to Green Cove Springs. It's a half hour drive. So back then it would be a significant train ride. And there, you know, the sandbar kept moving. So to come there by sea was always a challenge. I know Emerson stayed there and he left on a sailboat, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. And this was in the 1820s. And supposedly there was no wind. So they had for 6 weeks, they're trying to catch a breeze, you know, just kind of hanging out.
Oh, that's going to suck. So you had just the luxury of writing about all these wonderful, wonderful places and traditions and things that used to happen in Florida that maybe some people couldn't quite believe. What do you do? I mean, do you spend a lot of time at the Springs? What motivated you to write this book? What was the impetus?
It really grew out of the first book. And the first book started because I went to the Fountain of Youth attraction in St. Augustine. And, you know, I grew up in Florida and my dad taught me that you don't go to tourist traps like that. You know, they just want your money and you just don't do it. So as a graphic designer, which is what I do for a living, I loved everything campy and kitschy. And I saw this picture of the campy and kitschy. I don't know if the figures are made out of wax or plaster or what. Ponce de Leon and the Native Americans right by the Fountain of Youth. At the Fountain Youth attraction in St. Augustine. And so I wanted to go there and waste my own money and not listen to my dad. And I fell in love with the place. And I thought, oh my God, I've missed a whole side of Florida that I've taken for granted. And I kind of made it my mission. I started a blog. And then I started to kind of collect other fountains of youth and anything related to Ponce de Leon, you know, ephemera and stories and everything I could about it. I got a little obsessed. But part of that came every spring at some point or another, if it's commercially marketed, was called the Fountain of Youth. And so I started collecting evidence of that and collecting the stories. And, you know, the whole idea of, you know, rejuvenating water dovetails to the healing waters. And I've always been fascinated with the Victorian era. I love the whole style. You know, I love they love exoticism and just lots of stuff. And, you know, there's a whole visual aspect that I love about it. So there are these wonderful, remarkable wooden hotels that no longer exist at all these places in Florida. And they're all the evidence we have that they were there is mostly, you know, stereographs and postcards and advertising. And there was very little written about them. So I thought, each of these places has a unique story, was a unique place in a destination that was very popular at the time. And I want to tell their stories. And then I wanted to give context to why those places were popular. So I started going backwards in time to the whole reason why water was thought to have healing powers, which leads to the sacredness of water, which, you know, I ended up in Bath, England and going to the Glastonbury to see the Chalice Well and all this stuff. I could have written volumes on the sacredness of water. Yeah, you're yawning.
No, it's not. I'm sorry. No.
I had to cut all that stuff out though, because there was so much to it. And I got obsessed again. And, you know, it's like if you could do like a family tree kind of diagram with the Florida healing spas, you know, there would be one branch that would be sea bathing, one branch would be hydrotherapy, and then drinking water is a whole nother part of that. And that's why I put like the Fountain of Youth in St. Pete in there, because people believed for a very long time in the efficacy of the water. It was basically a well, you know.
The city I live in, Gulfport, we have a freshwater spring that is right on the shore of Boca Ciega Bay. And it's really, we do a walking tour at the museum. And when I give the walking tour, it's always fun to point it out to people, because if they're not super familiar with Florida's historic geology, the first question, of course, is, well, why is there a spring right by the ocean? And you say, well, the Gulf used to go out about 100 more miles. And more to the point, Florida is just pockmarked with springs. We have more springs in Florida than anywhere else on the planet. And that in and of itself is, to me, spectacular. It's remarkable that we have almost a thousand that we know of. And certainly that doesn't even count the ones that we've ruined and have dried or had saltwater intrusion. So No, I think it's great that you wrote the book. I would hope that you have another book coming to talk about those springs. And you have another one in you, you think? What are you working on next?
I do a lot of, you know, I always end with an environmental message when I talk about, and I've done a lot of talks for environmental organizations, because that's a really, you know, if you talk about the springs, you have to talk about how they're at risk, because they're all at risk. I don't know if I'm going to stay in that vein. I'm really, you know, the other theme that's in both of my books is the history of Florida tourism. And I'm really interested in how we kind of went from a state that at the middle of the 19th century had almost as many enslaved people as we did people of European descent. How we went from there to being marketed as this, the Sunshine State, you know, this slick, glossy place, how we kind of changed our whole image, and how certain vestiges of our past were preserved with this whole idea of the romantic idea of the South, plantations and all that kind of stuff. In some instances were preserved, you know, like antebellum dresses at Cypress Gardens, where others were completely whitewashed away. And so how that squeaky clean image evolved is kind of what I'm interested in now.
I am fascinated by how tourism evolved. In fact, in my forthcoming book, which is not yet published, it's at the press now, they've edited it, it's going to readers this week. I have a whole chapter about Key West and its evolution as a tourist mecca, because people don't realize this, but that was all a WPA project. This idea of Key West is this beautiful tropical paradise just littered with artists was completely made up. Just they needed help and it worked. And it's, to me, the epitome of the Florida reinvention of things, because you take a rock in the middle of the ocean, and there's no sandy beaches. There are no artists there. There's really nothing there. And you turn it into one of the most visited places on the planet per square inch. And I think that that's a great, great topic for you to explore. I would be interested, knowing you're a graphic designer and looking at some of the art you found for this book, I would love to see the old tourist posters. And I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Barnhill. He's just was an incredible postcard photographer who colored his pictures of the St. Petersburg area and sold them to tourists for not even a fraction of what they're worth. We have such a rich history of creating paradise that I am very excited about that book. When are you going to write it, and when can I read it?
I'm
no
still
pressure,
in the middle,
by the way.
I'm still in the middle of research, because it's not all, you know, I'm familiar with Barnhill. It's not all the pretty stuff. It's like the Lewis Plantation, you know, the ugly side of that, and how, you know, what started me on this is there's a exhibit in the little museum up in Enterprise, Florida, that was created by incarcerated people who looked at De Leon Springs, you know, where you make pancakes, which is one of my favorite places always. You know, it's like, where's your favorite place? Go make pancakes at De Leon Springs. But they, you know, there was something in that exhibit that just kind of turned that whole idea upside down, that the old Spanish mill there where you make pancakes is a symbol of slavery, and that we had all these incredible, we have all these sugar mills along the Gulf or East Florida that were destroyed in the Second Seminole War. And the Second Seminole War wasn't really just about the Seminoles. It was also a big slave rebellion. Again, a thing that kind of turned my whole idea upside down. And so these are stories that kind of have changed the way I'm coming to look at Florida, that, you know, these narratives haven't continued, you know. So a lot of these old sugar mills are now state parks or historical sites, but it's told from the point of view of the sugar mill owner and not about generations of enslaved people who lived there and labored there and made it possible. And that, you know, the Seminole War, the Seminole Wars that were fought here were as much about enslaved Black people as they were about pushing the Seminoles out of the way. You know, they wanted to be free, and all these escaped enslaved people were coming into Florida, and they wanted to stop that. So that kind of has started me on this track to see. I think that's where we really started to, you know, began to change the narrative as we became a tourist destination. And there's aspects of that people don't want to be out in the sun, you know, in the sunshine.
I agree. I think you talk about the Seminole. I think about forts. Fort Christmas is the one that comes to mind. We paint that with such a pretty brush. Come get your Christmas cards postmarked at Fort Christmas. And I always ask people when I talk about it, I say, why do you think we had a fort in the middle of the state? What were we protecting against? And people don't realize it was basically to annihilate the Seminole people. You know, but there's a lot with that.
It's really complicated. Yeah,
that's an exciting subject. Do you think you would come back and talk to us again about that?
I'm just really, starting the research, and I'm trying to understand it better. And, you know, the Seminoles are a great example because, you know, they kind of morphed into this thing that was, you know, like Silver Springs had a Seminole village. And it's so strange in a lot of ways. You know, there was, after the Seminole, those wars, you know, the most costliest wars of Indian removal in American history, millions of dollars of, you know, 19th century money were spent to try and eradicate the Seminoles. And then all of a sudden they're like this little sideshow attraction. And it's very complicated because, you know, it's real complicated. And I am just scratching the surface of my understanding. I don't know that I'll ever completely understand that, you know, from their perspective.
Well, I've done some research. I have, again, there is a chapter in the forthcoming book about the Seminole Tribe of Florida, because I argue that they are one of the most spectacular things about our state. And they were gracious enough to let me do some research. And I hope to go back again as soon as we're all 100% back from whatever 2020 was. At their Tribal Historic Preservation Office, TIPO, there's some archives. And they let me go into the archives and look at some of the history they've kept. And it blew me away just how very different their story is from the ones we've been told. And it's heartbreaking because you layer in the tourism and the fact that these people were basically treated like a sideshow. It's complex, and it's a hard story to tell properly. You know, we can't just talk about Coppingers and Musa Isles and all these places without really talking about, like you said, Rick, you went from trying to exterminate an entire people to come set up a quaint little village for us. And I'm interested. And as I said, I'd love to have you back and talk about it. I think this might be our longest podcast to date, but you've been fascinating. No, please don't apologize. We've gone from Kellogg's enemas to warm mineral springs to tourism. I mean, it's really just a very, let's go with robust. It's been a robust 40 some odd minutes, and I would love to have you back. I'm anxious to see the next book if you get to it, and I'm sure you will. And for everybody listening, we'll put the information about Rick's books in the show notes. But just to recap, it's Florida's Healing Waters, Gilded Age Mineral Springs, Seaside Resorts and Health Spas. And our guest today has been Rick Kilby. Rick, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute delight.
It's been my pleasure, and I can't wait to see your book. So it's at the readers now. So what do you got, another year or something?
I would assume a year. I've asked them for a fall launch, and I know fall 2021 is not possible. So yeah. I'm content to wait. As I said, I have some fiction I'm working on. I have another nonfiction book I want to write, but that's going to be contingent on some permissions I don't know if I'll get. It's been edited once. It's gone to readers. I'm hopeful that they'll tear it apart and make it better. For those of you listening, Rick and I share a press, the University Press of Florida, and the way academic presses work, even if our books aren't academic, is after they accept your book and you send the manuscript, your editor gives you some edits, you make the edits, you send it back to them, and then they find two readers in the field who don't know you very well and aren't considered friendly with you necessarily, but are familiar with your subject matter, to read it, give their feedback. Then you edit it again, And then there's a whole process, I think, hopping on one foot backwards in a full moon. I'm not clear on the inner workings of the press. So
it's
yeah,
agonizing, I'll say that.
it was the first book. I wasn't sure what to expect, and I swore I would never publish with a conventional press again. And then they did so very well by me that I don't think I would, for nonfiction, I don't know if I would ever go anywhere else. I have the best editor on the planet as far as I'm concerned. And she makes my writing so much better. I don't think I could do anything without her anymore. So anyway, yes, my book sometime in 2022, we're hopeful. But right now we're going to focus on yours. Thanks for being here today. And we will see you all again soon.